Welcome back to Academic Age and Retrospective. This is part 8, and today we're going to be looking at economic history and a series of videos, the Economics That Ruined series, where I looked at Venezuela, Zimbabwe, Ethiopia, Liberia, and Haiti. These are some of my most popular videos. A lot of people telling me that this is their favorite series. I also did a brief economic history of Wales to celebrate St. David's Day in 2019. And I did a video on the Shah's White Revolution, a little-known event in Iranian history that I would say laid the groundwork for the actual the Islamic Revolution that came in 1979. Incidentally, my mother wouldn't speak to me for a couple of days after I made that Economic History of Wales video. Let's just say it runs counter to a lot of the favoured explanations by the miners and the mining community. Anyway, just before we hit play on these, I'll remind you, all this week I'm running this retrospective series as a tie-in. If you use the code RETRO, that's the code RETRO, on the Academic Agency, you can get £100 off any of the bundles available on the site. Make use of that while you can. Suffice to say, I hope you enjoy these. Some rather grim details in some of these, but hopefully you'll learn something about how the world works and how some of these nations have worked. Why they're so poor today. In the news currently and for the past year or so, you've likely been watching the sad and rapid destruction of Venezuela. In this video, I want to explore the economic policies that have led to this sorry state of affairs. I'm mainly going to concentrate on the policies enacted by Hugo Chavez, who was the president between 1998 and 2013. But we need to start the story a little earlier than that, to get a fuller picture. In 1959, Venezuela elected a broadly socialist president called Romulo Betancourt. Although he did not do anything too drastic beyond tripling the income tax rate and devaluing the currency, he did, through the establishment of the Venezuelan constitution, set the groundwork for a more activist state than the country had seen up until this point. That potential would be realised a decade later when Carlos Anders Perez came to power and nationalised the petroleum sector, establishing the PDVSA, and a welfare state funded by deficit spending. Perez would establish a pattern that would become familiar from here on in Venezuela, using oil money to pay for various social welfare schemes. This naturally concentrated a lot of power in the oil industry, which effectively politicized the PDVSA forever, leaving it ripe for corruption and rampant cronyism. The next president, Luis Herrera Campins, instituted currency exchange controls, which included wide-ranging domestic price controls in a bid to curb rising prices. But falling oil prices kept devaluing the Bolivar in the 1980s and left Venezuela in economic crisis. Things would come to a head under the next president, Jaime Lucchini, as many corruption scandals involving the Venezuelan ruling class were exposed. This gave rise to socialist populism in the country, led by agitators such as Hugo Chavez, a dissident colonel in the army. In 1989, Perez was brought back to institute a series of IMF reforms to try to get spending under control and to liberalise the country's economy. However, such was the institutional corruption in the country, especially that PDVSA to social program pipeline, that Perez did not really get a lot done. Although his second presidency was rocked by a coup attempt in 1992 by none other than Hugo Chavez, and he was eventually impeached for corruption. Things bumbled on for the next few years until in 1998, riding the wave of socialist populism from discontented poor workers, Chavez became the president. And this is where the interventionist economic policies really start ramping up. Immediately, Chavez set about establishing worker-owned cooperatives. There were over 100,000 of these established, comprising around 1.5 million workers. To give you an idea of what that means, in 1998, the population of Venezuela was 23.41 million people. So, the cooperatives accounted for around 6.6% of people. By 2007, around 30% of state funds were controlled by these communal councils. They had established over 300 communal banks, which were mandated to give microloans to these cooperatives when they needed them. In fact, around 3% of reserves had to be maintained just for these loans. And to help pay for all this, Chavez also increased the income tax rate to 61.7%. So, how did these cooperatives work out? Well, despite praise from the UN and various other leftist groups, including a project strangely in the Bronx in New York, the cooperatives did not function as hoped. A census in 2006 showed that as many as 50% of the cooperatives were either functioning improperly or were frequently created just to gain access to public funds. In other words, state subsidies for worker cooperatives create strong incentives for corruption. The next major Chavez policy was his hydrocarbon laws. These were intended to stamp out any lingering vestiges of private enterprise in Venezuela's oil industry, and mandated that at least 51% of the PDVSA had to be owned directly by the government. In practice, this meant that oil experts were replaced by Chavez cronies. For example, in 2002, he installed this chap, Gaston Parra Luzardo, as the president of the PDVSA. Luzardo was a leftist economics professor who knew absolutely nothing about how to run oil facilities. He was, simply put, a fiercely idealistic opponent of private industry, and he went on to replace most of the PDVSA management with other socialist lackeys. Chavez also increased foreign cooperation repatriation of oil revenues from 16.7% to 30%. Of the $15 billion being generated by the PDVSA, Chavez diverted around $4 billion to pay for various socialist schemes he called Bolivarian missions. In fact, the Chavez formula was pretty simple. Expropriate oil money for Bolivarian missions in exchange for votes in elections so he could continue to claim that Venezuela was an example of democratic socialism as opposed to Soviet-style dictatorship. And for what it's worth, at least this part of things worked, as Chavez did keep winning the majority of votes in elections. And what were the effects of these oil policies? Well, for one, it increased the dependency of Venezuelan exports on oil from 77% when he took power to 89% by 2006 and 95% by 2012. In the vernacular, you might call this putting all your eggs in one basket. And of course, this made the Venezuelan economy even more fragile than it had been in the 1980s, because now price shocks could cause real devastation. And in 2008, when the financial crisis hit, oil prices fell from $129 a barrel to $43 a barrel. So if you get a 66% price drop in a product on which your economy depends for over 90% of its export income, you don't need a PhD in economics to figure out it's not good news. However, Venezuela would not have been as vulnerable as this had it not been for several other measures that Chavez took. In 2003,
he instituted price controls on food. And in 2005, he started wide-scale land redistributions in earnest. Now let me look at these policies and their effects more closely. Chavez set strict price controls across a whole range of basic foods. This led food producers who did not want to sell below cost to try to smuggle their goods to foreign markets. Chavez put an end to this by seizing over 750 tons of food at the border. He punished firms who failed to comply with the price controls by nationalizing large farms and supermarkets, stating, "The land is not private, it is the property of the state." He set minimum production quotas on 12 basic food items. In addition, he redistributed 2.7 million hectares of land from private owners to 180,000 landless peasants. He decriminalized the peasant occupation of idle private land and increased agricultural credit, essentially government farm subsidies, from $168 million in 1998 to $7.6 billion in 2008. So, what happened? Well, the state-owned supermarkets known as McCall's were forced to sell food at 39% below market rates. Naturally, this led to huge queues and shortages, as such measures always do. Of course, this was compounded by state inefficiency. For example, in 2010, over 120,000 tons of food lay rotting in the nationalized port at Puerto Cabello. Because of all of this, food imports increased by around six times in this period, increasing to $7.5 billion and accounting for around 70% of all food. And to give some context, before Chavez came to power, Venezuela produced 70% of its own food. One reason for this drastic change is that Chavez's policies led to a drastic reduction in food output. Between 1998 and 2014, food production decreased 75% for beef and veal, 40.3% for maize, 38.9% for rice, 33.6% for sugar, 46.5% for coffee, 63.5% for potatoes, 31% for tomatoes, 24.6% for onions. And astonishingly, while all of this was going on, the UN was actually praising Chavez's policy. They were praising him for reducing poverty. On top of all of this, Chavez nationalized whole swathes of the rest of the economy: cement production, electricity, telephones, steel. All of these industries experienced a decline in production output or operational efficiency. And from 2013 onwards, the power grid started to experience nationwide brownouts. And remarkably, despite all of these facts, as late as 2017, leftists such as Slavoj Žižek were saying that the real problem in Venezuela is that Chavez had not gone far enough. Because, you know, real socialism has never been tried. Since Chavez, under his successor, Nicolas Maduro, things have just gone from bad to worse, and now the regime is on the cusp of being overthrown. Now, I will let you decide whether or not this was real socialism, but the point is, no matter what you call it, nationalization, price controls, massive deficit spending on out-of-control welfareism and social schemes, and the failure to protect basic property rights lead to catastrophic outcomes wherever they have been tried. Don't let people fool you into doing these things to your own country. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Sir Percy Blakeney, the Crimson Satyr, the Ambivalent Onion, Andy Swainson, Bailey in Aurora, David Vacherche, Christopher Scholholm, Natural Rights, Binary Surfer, Holy Spatula, Hornito Jones, Kazga, Michael Tynan, Time Stealer, Toyotomi Ami, Tragic Vision, William Angus, Blake Barrows, and Edward Darra.
The nation of Zimbabwe is today generally known as an economic basket case.
featuring endemic poverty, periods of starvation, and chronic unemployment. In this video, I want to explore the economic policies enacted by Robert Mugabe that led to all of this. First, however, I want to go back to look at the economy in Zimbabwe before Mugabe came to power. Up until 1964, southern Rhodesia had been part of the British Empire, and it just so happens that the administration kept incredibly detailed economic data. I have obtained a copy of their final report, published in September 1964, and it makes for some very interesting reading. Southern Rhodesia, it turns out, was an almost textbook case for how to run an efficient, healthy, growing economy while keeping a balanced budget. As you can see here, from 1954 to 1963, there was a 65.8% increase in export revenue, while they reduced reliance on imports by 23.2%, so that the country was in a trade surplus. There was a steady increase of non-African migrants, mostly from Europe and Asia. You can see that by 1963, there were over 88,000 of them working in various industries. However, the vast majority of industrial workers were local Africans. As you can see, for most of the decade, around 600,000 were employed. The non-African workers were generally very well paid, and that is because many of them were direct investors, especially on the farmlands. Foreign companies accounted for 75% of total agricultural corporate profits and 61% of gross capital formation. Other non-African workers, especially Asians, were brought in as skilled labour and as foremen, and similar supervisory roles. They were naturally paid much higher wages than the local population, owing to their higher productivity and the fact that they paid much higher prices in pounds sterling in the so-called European economy, as opposed to the local African economy, which would have used a local currency, in which prices were a fraction of what non-Africans would have paid. In fact, this two-tier dual economy between locals and Westerners persists in many places in Africa even today. I would also note that the average African worker employed in European-owned industries experienced a 78.1% increase in wages in just 9 years, from 1954 to 1963, as compared with a 37.6% increase for non-African workers in the same period. I don't think a 78% pay increase in under a decade is anything bad. In fact, these urban industrial workers were incredibly better off than many of their fellow natives, as we shall see. And just to show, one reason for these pay increases was because GDP almost doubled in this period, rising from £161.5 million in 1954 to £306.3 million in 1963. This was helped by the incredibly balanced budget that the British administration kept, maintaining a surplus in every single year, something which very few governments seem to be able to do today. Now, some of you might be thinking that the number of these workers in this data is quite small, and that is because the total population of southern Rhodesia around this time was 6 million people, almost all of whom were local Africans. So where were the other 5.4 million people? What were they doing? They were not all unemployed, but rather many of them were working in the so-called peasant economy. Traditionally, the economy of this region was divided into European and African agriculture. The former brought more modern farming methods, while the latter more or less carried on as they had always done, using indigenous methods. Tribal trust lands covered around 40% of the total area of southern Rhodesia, and these were still run by traditional chiefs, virtually untouched by the British. There were other areas set aside for natives to farm on themselves. These were called native purchase areas, which had been established in 1930. The peasant economy was spread across these two different types of areas, and around 70% of the population relied on this, largely at subsistence level. Some of these native areas suffered from unemployment and low productivity. In the 19th century, the peasant farms dominated grain production, but these were overtaken by European-style farming after World War I, and by World War II, African production of grain had faded into insignificance. One issue is that Africans could not afford to buy the land set aside for them in native purchase areas. Incidentally, the native purchase areas were very successful in their own terms. By the 1960s, they accounted for one-third of African agricultural output, even though they were totally only 2% of African farming households. So, in 1951, the government passed the Native Land Husbandry Act, which introduced individual tenure under government control in the tribal reserves, emphasizing individual responsibility. And this did make a contribution to increased grain production in the 1950s. Native grain production increased for two reasons. First, international grain prices made imports more expensive. And second, the European farms were switching from grain to the more lucrative tobacco market, which led to an increase in demand for the African farm grain. However, the Native Land Husbandry Act was actually an attempt by the British to create a native middle-class population consisting of an urban elite and a larger land-owning peasantry who would become a rural elite. In fact, the British administration spent over £15.8 million on this in the decade of the 1950s. One reason for this was to offset overpopulation in the reserve areas, which was causing soil erosion, especially since the European agricultural sector was in full employment. If you look at the policy, it is largely assimilation of private land ownership, upheld by property rights for the natives. However, for whatever reason, they were largely resistant to these proposed changes, and this policy was abandoned in the 1960s. One issue they had was that male absentee rates, that is, men who would abandon their families, reached over 50% during this period. This meant that in many cases, they were relying on single mothers with dependent children to sign for this land. They were supposed to receive between 57 and 67 acres per family, but take-up was very minimal. By 1963, only 0.15% of land had changed hands, and a quarter of the entitled families were landless. Besides, the rise of the aforementioned rural and urban native elites was starting to cause a problem for the white settler population as they began to vie for political power. These were the conditions under which Ian Smith unilaterally declared independence from the British Empire in 1964, and Rhodesia became, for 15 years, a rogue nation which was not internationally recognised. Let us fast forward now to 1979, when Robert Mugabe rose to power, overthrowing Ian Smith and the white minority after a bitter civil war called the Rhodesian Bush War. Mugabe was nominally a Marxist and a socialist, but the base of his support was the rural peasantry, which he fueled by nationalist populism mixed with anti-white and anti-colonial rhetoric. Mugabe formally took power as Prime Minister in 1980, and he launched a radical set of economic policies from the start. He introduced a minimum wage, administered price controls, he made legislation making it virtually impossible to fire workers, a 60% increase in public sector expenditure, which included many state schools and a universal healthcare system, high tariffs on imports, and a license system for new investments in which all private sector investment had to be rubber stamped by the government. Mugabe's 1980s policies tend to be described as a form of corporatism typical of social democracy. What were the effects of these policies? First, there was white flight. Many skilled white workers emigrated. The tariffs raised the cost of industrial produce, which damaged the export economy. Foreign direct investment plummeted because of the licensing rules and because administrative controls effectively crowded out investment. There was a chronic budget deficit, and the minimum wage laws and prohibition of firings represented very high opportunity costs for employers producing unemployment. There was another overall effect of these constraints, which is that they favoured existing capital-intensive and largely white producers, who were also discouraged from taking on additional labour by the controls over wages and employment. This had two politically significant consequences. First, it suppressed the emergence of a genuinely entrepreneurial African business class and reduced the political support of those that did make it their way, despite these problems. Second, it turned unemployment into a major threat to the legitimacy of the regime, especially in urban areas. Wages were actually allowed to decline over the decade, so the minimum wage probably did not discourage employment, although controls over dismissal almost certainly did. In fact, Zimbabwe, even before the Mugabe regime, had a very large informal employment sector, that is, people who are effectively working but outside the formal legal structure. People can work informally as tailors, carpenters, traders, cooks, taxi drivers, any number of things, but they are not captured in official statistics. Here in the UK, we'd call it the black market, but these practices are so common in African countries that it would be meaningless to use that term. But this tendency is massively exacerbated by the sorts of bureaucratic employment demands enacted by Mugabe in the 1980s. However, despite all of this, Zimbabwe had GDP growth of around 7.1% for the 1980s. This is partly because international sanctions, which had been imposed on the unrecognized Rhodesia, had been lifted. But because of those sanctions, the Rhodesian economy after 1968 became diversified to substitute for input goods which they could no longer get. In fact, between 1965 and 1974, Rhodesia saw 7% GDP growth. This was disrupted by the Civil War, but in many ways you can see Mugabe simply inheriting this old economy with a very similar rate of growth. However, this masks the fact that by 1989, Zimbabwe was facing an economic crisis. Here is Mugabe himself on the matter. Employment creation has averaged a mere 10,000 jobs per annum over the 10 years of independence, far short of the planned target of 144,000 per annum. Investment levels fell in real terms from 15.5% of GDP in 1980 to 10.7% in 1989. In the 1990s, Zimbabwe came under international pressure, especially from the IMF, to bring its spending under control and to liberalize its heavily protectionist economy. Perhaps because he recognized that his policies hadn't worked, Mugabe largely welcomed this. However, while protections were removed and wage and price controls relaxed, Mugabe was unable to reduce his deficit spending, which was exacerbated by three droughts in 1992, 1993, and 1995. It's safe to say that Zimbabwe did not have a very good 1990s. The liberal reforms combined with the droughts saw a short-term shock similar to those in Eastern Europe when they were trying to liberalize after communism. As manufacturing was hit and production fell, a sizable trade deficit opened up. Despite a recovery after 1996, GDP per capita was actually lower in 1999 than it had been in 1990. However, there was some cause for optimism in 1997 because after this difficult transition period, GDP growth hit 7.3% in 1996, and exports had increased from 23.1% of GDP in 1991 to 36.1% in 1996. There was also a sharp increase in foreign direct investment, which rose to $51 million in 1996, which was 70% higher than the 1980s peak. Had Zimbabwe stuck to this course, this would likely have continued. However, the period of transition had caused some political unrest, and Mugabe simply lost patience. He reverted to his former corporatism, making large payments to war veterans that undermined fiscal discipline, land appropriations, policy reversals on taxation and prices, and a decision to send the Zimbabwean army to Congo in 1998, which the country really couldn't afford. Zimbabwe defaulted on its loans from the IMF, the World Bank, and the African Development Bank in 1999. Corporatist controls over the exchange rate and many other prices were re-established, and this destroyed the viability of many firms and reduced the incentive to invest. It also led to capital flight and the near total withdrawal of foreign direct investment. Violent expropriations of white farms followed. As a result, GDP fell by about 40% between 2000 and 2007. Inflation was more than 165,000% by the beginning of 2008. To give you an idea, $50 billion Zimbabwean dollars in 2008 was worth only $198. Food production reduced by 50% and industrial output by 47%. By 2007, the poverty rate was at 80% and the unemployment rate, one of the highest recorded by any country ever, was at 95% by 2009. So what then? Zimbabwe had little choice but to dump its own currency and adopt the US dollar, which was already largely being used on the black market. But aside from that, Mugabe essentially doubled or even tripled down. In 2007, he signed the Indigenization and Economic Empowerment Act, which gave indigenous Zimbabweans the right to take over any foreign-owned company. An indigenous Zimbabwean is defined as any person who was born before the 18th of April 1980 who was disadvantaged by unfair discrimination on the grounds of his or her race, and any descendant of such a person. Over 51% of white-owned companies in the country would be transferred to indigenous Zimbabwean ownership. Mugabe sought to offset rising prices with even more stringent price controls and actually sent the police to force shopkeepers to sell stock at a loss. He also doubled the size of the civil service. That's right, doubled the size of the civil service. Let's have a look at the effect of this madness. Debt hit over 200% of GDP. A nurse's daily salary at one point was said to be just 12 US cents, less than the price of a soft drink. Endemic currency shortages led to the government forcing banks to limit cash withdrawals. Shop shelves were often completely empty. Many foreign companies, including Heinz, KFC, and Tata, simply shut up shop and left the country. There are endemic petrol shortages, and queues apparently stretch for miles. Now, Mugabe might be gone in 2019, but many of these same problems remain. From what I can see, his replacement, Emmerson Mnangagwa, seems to have no intentions of abandoning Mugabe's command and control style of economic management. Just last month, in January 2019, he announced a 150% increase in the price of fuel, which led to widespread protests. He was actually the mastermind behind the Indigenization and Economic Empowerment Bill and was in positions of power in the Mugabe regime from 1980 onwards, which meant that he was one of the people responsible for much of what I've discussed in the rest of this video. I dread to think what is going to happen next. As I said when discussing Venezuela, you can decide whether or not this is real socialism. But what is striking is how many of the policies are exactly the same. Price controls, currency devaluation, punitive state controls on business, endemic deficit spending, land redistribution, and a basic failure to uphold private property rights. the name matters less than the policies themselves. Do not let it happen in your own country. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Sir Percy Blakeney, the Crimson Satyr, the Ambivalent Onion, Andy Swainson, Bailey in Aurora, David Vacherche, Christopher Scholholm, Natural Rights, Binary Surfer, Holy Spatula, Hornito Jones, Kazga, Michael Tynan, Time Stealer, Toyo Tommy Ami, Tragic Vision, William Angus, Blake Barrows, and Edward Darra.
When most Westerners think of Ethiopia, no doubt their mind goes to images like this, and the memory of Bob Geldof raising money in the mid-1980s for Live Aid. What is not often mentioned is that from 1974 to 1991, Ethiopia was under a brutal communist dictatorship, explicitly Marxist-Leninist in ideology and methods, called the Derg. Although the Derg would have several leaders in its early years, by 1977, this man, Mengistu Haile Mariam, generally just called Mengistu, had outmaneuvered his rivals and consolidated his power. In this video, I'm going to have a look at his economic policies and their effects during this period. With the assistance of the Soviet Union, the Derg overthrew the old emperor, Haile Selassie, in 1974. Selassie had ruled the country since 1916 and became internationally famous after occupation by Mussolini's fascist Italy in 1935. Ethiopia, also known as Abyssinia, had had contact with Europe going back centuries to the ancient world. It is a resource-rich country with fertile soil and good rainfall. By the 19th century, coffee had emerged as an important cash crop for the country. Ethiopia also historically traded wheat, corn, millet, gold, ivory, musk, and wild animal skins. It had long raised cattle and sheep also. However, it was never a great trading nation because of local hostility to commerce. The people tended to despise merchants and traders and looked instead to priests and warriors as their leaders. This was quite deep-rooted, to the extent that even after World War II, most of Ethiopia was still a barter economy because only a tiny fraction of the population actually used money. Wage labour was limited, economic units were largely self-sufficient, foreign trade was negligible, and the market for manufactured goods was extremely small. This had other knock-on effects. For example, it was very hard for Selassie's government to collect taxes, and they had to rely on customs, excise, and sales to generate revenue. As late as the 1970s, import tariffs accounted for over a third of government revenues and two-fifths of all taxes. In the 1950s, Selassie had wanted to transition from a subsistence agricultural economy, in which most people raised their own livestock, to a more agro-industrial one. Between 1957 and 1973, he launched three consecutive five-year plans to try to achieve this. Although they did not fully modernize the economy, they were a moderate success, achieving an average of 4.4% annual GDP per capita growth from 1960 to 1970. Manufacturing growth doubled from 1.9% in 1960 to 4.4% in 1973. And the growth rate for the wholesale, retail trade and transportation and communication sectors increased from 9.3% to 15.6%. Regionally, this economic performance was better than Sudan, which had an annual growth rate of 1.9%, but not as good as Kenya's 6% GDP growth or Uganda's 5.6% growth. By the early 70s, the economy had started to diversify a little bit, but four-fifths of the country's population were still subsistence farmers who lived in poverty because they used most of their meagre production to pay taxes rents, debt payments, and bribes. And during this whole period, Ethiopia ran a trade deficit. That is, it imported more than it exported. This can be fine for a developed, cash-rich country like the UK, but generally speaking, developing countries grow through exporting more than they import. So, when the communists took over, the Derg inherited a mostly agricultural peasant economy with a very small urban industrial population. Over 80% of the population were still peasant farmers. In fact, most of Ethiopia was practically a feudal economy. Aristocrats and the church owned most of the land. Peasant farmers paid them exorbitant rents. There was practically no business enterprise beyond this to speak of for at least four-fifths of the population. So when they took power in January of 1975, the Derg immediately nationalized or took partial control of over 100 companies, including banks and other financial institutions and insurance companies. Then, in March 1975, they nationalized all rural land and granted the peasants possessing rights to parcels of land around 10 hectares each. These land reform measures are often called villagization, and they were a vast resettlement program. By 1989, more than 13 million people were said to have been villagized. The 1975 Land Reform Proclamation stated that the government shall have the responsibility to settle peasants or to establish cottage industries to accommodate those who, as a result of distribution of land, remain with little or no land. Essentially, this policy was very similar to the Soviet Union's collectivization of farms. Disparate peasants who were scattered around rural areas were rounded up and forced into villages, which some at the time compared to Hitler's concentration camps. Farmers were often moved during the planting and harvesting seasons. There were predictably disastrous results, which I will discuss soon. In December 1975, they issued Proclamation 76, which put a 500,000 birr, that's just under 20,000 1975 US dollars, price ceiling on private investment, and urged Ethiopians to invest in enterprises larger than cottage industries. They introduced rural land use fee and tax on income from agricultural activities to replace the old feudal tax system. They delegated collection of these taxes to peasant associations, but right until the very end of the regime, practical problems with actually collecting taxes from these rural areas persisted. They also put a 2% tax on exports and 19% tariffs on all imports. Luxury goods and certain other consumer goods were subject to high sales taxes. In a bid to curb inflation, they also instituted price controls, used the newly nationalized bank officially to overvalue the birr, and froze wages of government staff on more than 600 birr a month, that's around 21 US dollars. So that was a freeze for basically most of the government staff. Later, in 1987, Mengistu would establish a new constitution that would retroactively legalize all of these changes with the decree, Article 2 in the constitution, which declared that the state shall guide the economic and social activities of the country through a central plan. So what were the effects of all of this? Well, from 1974 to 78, they were mostly engaged in a civil war, and growth plummeted to 0.4%. The K-Shabur, or Ethiopian Red Terror, modelled on the Soviet terror — the Derg were not just Leninists, they frequently quoted Stalin as well — ravaged the country until 1977. During this time, they killed anywhere between 30,000 and 750,000 people. Then there was the matter of the Ogaden War with Somalia, which took place between 1977 and 1978. During this time, prices experienced a 16.5% annual increase, and the national deficit widened because a lot of money was being spent on military supplies. From 1978 to 1980, GDP grew at an average annual rate of 5.7%, benefiting from good weather. Agricultural production increased at an average annual rate of 3.6%, and manufacturing increased at an average annual rate of 8.9%, as many closed plants, particularly in Eritrea, reopened. The current account deficit and overall fiscal deficit remained below 5% of GDP during this period. But all of this relatively rosy stuff between 78 and 80 can largely be explained as returning to something resembling normality after a period of revolution, civil unrest, and violent conflict. However, as soon as we adjust for peacetime, the next fiscal year, 1980 to 1981, shows a decline in GDP growth. In fact, GDP growth declined every year from 1980 to 1985, apart from 82 to 83. And then the economy stagnated between 1985 and 1990. The unemployment rate increased from 11.5% annually from 1979 to 1988. It is estimated that of the rural population, around 50% of the workforce were unpaid family workers. Real wages dropped. For example, the starting salary of a science graduate in 1975 was 600 birr. By 1984, they received only 239 birr. In 1975, the maximum salary for a civil servant was 1,440 birr. In 1984, this had dropped to 573 birr. The average real money wages of an industrial worker in 1986 was 65.6% of the 1975 rate. As these real wages decreased, consumer prices rose. The real price index shows a 27% increase from 1980 to 1987, with food prices increasing 27%, household items 38%, and transportation 17%. When wages fall and prices rise, that is called a decrease in the standard of living. Agricultural production dropped 2.1% a year from 1980 to 1987, while the population grew by 2.4% a year. It is not hard to see from just these two numbers why there was a famine which killed over a million people from 1984 to 1986. State farms accounted for 43% of government expenditure on agriculture, but accounted for only 6% of agricultural output in 1987. The peasant farmers were still responsible for over 90% of output. In fact, so catastrophic were these results that on the 5th of March 1990, in a speech to the Workers' Party of Ethiopia Central Committee, sensationally renounced communism. He admitted that the Marxist-Leninist economic plan from 1974 to 1990 had utterly failed and announced a new strategy in which planning would be decentralized. Ethiopia was to embrace the free market and pursue a mixed economy in which the private and public sectors would play complementary roles. This was partly because the Soviet Union had withdrawn support for the Derg, and the following year, Mengistu would be overthrown, fleeing to Zimbabwe, where Robert Mugabe granted him political asylum as an official guest. It's possible he killed over 2 million people during his brutal regime, not including those who died of famine. And as far as I know, he's still living there in Zimbabwe now. So what about those land reforms? 5.5% of the peasants died of starvation or disease. 14% simply fled. Now, While Ethiopia did experience a severe drought in 1984, it strikes me that wide-scale famine, which killed over 1 million people and affected about 8 million more, were as much to do with these brutal reforms as they were to do with the weather. The same thing happened in the Ukraine in the 1930s, in China in the late 1950s, where over 30 million people died of famine, in North Korea in the late 1990s, and in Zimbabwe in the 2000s. Which of them was real socialism, I ask you? Of all the terrible policies I've been reviewing in this series so far, it seems to me that the lethal combination of land reform with price controls on food consistently has the most devastating results. As they say, those who don't learn from history are destined to repeat it. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Sir Percy Blakeney, The Crimson Satyr, The Ambivalent Onion, Andy Swainson, Bailey in Aurora, David Vacherche, Christopher Scholholm, Natural Rights, Binary Surfer, Holy Spatula, Hornito Jones, Kazga, Michael Tynan, Time Stealer, Toyo Tommy Ami, Tragic Vision, William Angus, Blake Barrows, and Edward Darrow.
Since it's St. David's Day and I'm a Welshman, I thought it appropriate to make this video looking at the economy of Wales. At the moment, the employment rate of 24.2% is its highest in history, and the unemployment rate of 4.3% is quite low. However, the poverty rate is 23%, and one in seven people are still on benefits, and this leads us to a central question that anyone looking honestly at the Welsh economy must ask. Why is Wales so poor? The GDP per capita of Wales is around £19,000, which is 58% of the EU average. And in truth, this relative poverty has been true for most of Wales's history. For hundreds of years, it was a sparsely populated rural area with difficult terrain. Its ports into the Bristol Channel are arguably less strategically useful than those which open into the Irish Sea, the English Channel, or the North Sea. That changed, of course, in the 19th century and the Industrial Revolution, when coal became a very important resource, especially in South Wales. If we look at the data from the 1850s to 1908, output of coal from the South Wales pits increased by 569.3%, and the population grew by 196.55%, from 232,000 to 688,000. However, during this period, the labour movement had begun in earnest, and there was a dramatic increase in strike action. In fact, mining had been one of the first industries to unionise, leading to a slew of government interventions in the industry throughout the 19th century, which I discuss in some detail in my video, Won't Someone Think of the Children? If you're interested, I'd recommend stopping this now and watching that and then coming back. But the upshot, as I argue there, is that decades of union agitation had led to an unholy trinity of union bosses, politicians and mine owners in settling these disputes by government legislation. One direct consequence of this is that the owners never modernised their equipment for fear of job losses. Some miners were still using pickaxes as late as the 1960s. As the situation in the United States shows, nothing about this was inevitable. Another direct consequence was massive protectionism for the coal industry from about 1900s onwards. This did nothing to stave off endemic strikes, but simply incentivized them further. In 1926, the UK government, now more or less directly in control of the coal industry, tried to reduce the wages of around 1.2 million coal miners, which were already well above market rates. This produced over 162 million lost working days through industrial action. This strike is still romanticised by Labour supporters as a remarkable show of solidarity, but its only real consequence was to reduce raw output, If we return to the data, we can see a 29.7% decrease in coal production in South Wales from 1908 to 1938. Furthermore, artificially inflated workers' wages set by government edict after numerous strikes had led to a 40% unemployment rate by the mid-1930s. I wonder how many trade unionists realised at the time that they practically killed the goose that laid the golden eggs. Going back to the numbers, we can see that even as coal output decreased, the population of South Wales, which remember had swelled entirely because of coal mining in the first place, did not decrease even as unemployment hit 40%. And then, after the Second World War, Clement Attlee came to power, and this had two big consequences for Wales. First, he nationalised the coal mines, which meant that they were now officially being controlled centrally by the UK government after having been unofficially run by them through various interventions since at least the 1910s. And second, since the workers represented such a huge chunk of the electorate, there was now a whole new attitude in the political classes of indulging each and every whim of the unions. This was common to both Labour and the Tory party during the so-called post-war consensus. We can see how each successive government caved into strike action by looking at the total number of industrial disputes, which skyrocketed after 1945, and the comparatively smaller number of working days lost to strikes. In lay terms, this means the government was simply caving in each and every time. And we can see very easily the results of this by looking at the miners' wages, which rose by 107% from 1948 to 1978, despite a 41% drop in total demand for coal in the same period. Now, can anyone see the problem here? Falling demand, rising wages, and drastically lower productivity. If we look at the unemployment statistics again, they mask a horrible reality. That 40% unemployment rate in the 1930s. Look at it again. Had the Welsh coal industry really recovered to such an extent that after the war over 400,000 jobs had come back to the area? I mean, it's possible that the government was using their new control over the industry as a form of mass welfare. A nationwide Keynesian make-work scheme to con people into believing, quote, they've never had it quite so good. You can judge that for yourselves, but one thing from this data is absolutely certain. The Welsh coal industry, in real terms, was deader than a dodo long before Margaret Thatcher stepped into Downing Street. That she is still blamed today for the death of mining is a gross injustice. Furthermore, many blame Thatcher for not finding new jobs for all those workers who were displaced when the mines closed. But it is simply not the government's role to find work for people. And the blame for conditioning a generation or two of Welsh people for believing that they should is to be squarely placed on those who maintained the illusion that they were providing them jobs in the first place. The Welsh economy from 1948 to 1978 was an entirely false economy. Now, for some viewers, this will be a bitter realization, but the data doesn't lie. Perhaps the worst legacy of this false economy is that it led to a posture of victimhood and helplessness in Wales. The Welsh still, even today, some 40 years after the facade was exposed, bemoan the fact that the coal mines were not replaced by anything. But surely it is not up to Westminster to replace industry, it is up to the Welsh people to develop their own industry, to innovate, to attract investment, to compete in business, to create jobs which the economy properly lost in the 1930s. As we have seen, not the 1980s, not even the 1970s, the 1930s. Unfortunately, most in Wales have yet to learn this lesson. Every year, Wales takes out £15 billion in tax revenue more than it pays in. That means the average person living in Wales represents a £2,026 cost to the UK economy as a whole. Where does this money come from? Well, from these figures, one can see quite clearly that it comes from London directly, which, through this chain of socialism, keeps Wales locked in vassalage, stealing its best talent while keeping the population in poverty, feeding from the so-called benevolent hand of benefits. And as long as this remains the case, Wales will revert to type as a poor and relatively obscure backwater to England. Happy St. David's Day. Now get out.
In the world of make-believe, Wakanda, an African ethno-state which has remained free of European colonial interference, looks like this. But I've always been about the real world on this channel, and thought it might be interesting to look at a real-life example of an African ethno-state which has remained free of European colonial interference. That example is Liberia. Like Wakanda, it is an ethno-state, but unlike Wakanda, it is on the West African coast as opposed to the East African coast. It has Sierra Leone to the northwest, Guinea to the north, and Ivory Coast to the east. It is rich in natural resources and has much fertile soil, which could be cultivated into cereals or cash crops. So what do we mean by ethno-state? We mean that there is a specifically racial element written into its constitution. White people, or indeed Asians, are not allowed to become Liberian citizens. It is reserved only for black people. Article 5, Section 13 of the 1847 Constitution states, "The great object of forming these colonies being to provide a home for the dispersed and oppressed children of Africa, and to regenerate and enlighten this benighted continent. None but persons of colour shall be eligible to citizenship in this republic." The phrasing "persons of colour" was changed to "Negroes" or "persons of Negro descent" in a 1955 revision. The country has been independent since 1847 and has no history of European colonialism. As the economist George Dalton put it in 1965, with the partial exception of Ethiopia, Liberia is the only country in Africa which was never the colony of a European power. It has been a sovereign republic since 1847. For those who are impressed by the favourite myth of African political leaders that before European colonisation, Africa must have enjoyed some sort of golden age because its present economic and social problems are the evil legacy of wicked European colonialism, an examination of Liberia is instructive. In this video, we're going to take a look at its history. The first settlements of former African American slaves in Liberia took place in 1822. Around 20,000 of them migrated from America to these settlements, which had been acquired legally from local tribes. Around 15,000 went there of their own accord, and around 5,000 were sent there after US gunships had apprehended illegal slave ships in the Atlantic. The Republic of Liberia was founded through the efforts of the American Colonization Society, aided and abetted by the government of the United States. The society was formed in 1816 and represented an attempt to establish a civilized Christian state in West Africa by repatriating liberated persons and providing them with the means of settlement, subsistence, and defense. Attempts were made in 1820 and 1821 to settle the coast. And finally, in the latter year, an arrangement was made with the natives and a town started, which was called Monrovia. The original negotiations were handled by two agents of the government and Captain Robert F. Stockton in command of the USS Alligator. From the earliest days of the settlement in 1821-1822 to the present, the Americo-Liberians have acted like Portuguese, British and Afrikaner colonists in other parts of Africa. They maintain an identity distinct from tribal persons in speech, dress, source and level of income, style of life and culture.
Indeed, their preference for politics, law, and plantations, and in their disdain for commerce, the descendants of the freed slaves are an aristocracy. Like European colonizers in other parts of Africa, the Americo-Liberians subdued the tribes with force and fraud for high-sounding purposes. The large land purchases, paid for with beads, muskets, tobacco, and umbrellas, were negotiated with chiefs to whom the practice of permanent alienation of land was unfamiliar. Americo-Liberian leaders said they had a manifest destiny to bring civilization to the tribal heathen. Slavery was to be suppressed, and the colony was to be a beachhead for Christianity in Africa. From 1821 to 1839, several Americo-Liberian settlements, independent from one another, were established along the coast on the initiative of the American Colonization Society to repatriate free Negroes, and similar organizations set up on its model in several American states. The first move towards consolidation into a central polity, the isolated coastal settlements joining together as a commonwealth, occurred in 1839 in response to tribal hostility. It was imperative that the isolated settlements band together for mutual defense. The Americo-Liberians learned early that the survival of their community depended on cohesion within. They learned also to defeat tribal uprisings with cannon and guns. As late as 1915, the United States government provided the settler community with military advisers and weapons to put down an uprising among the Crew, an energetic people who rebelled again in 1931-32. Eventually, in 1847, the Americo-Liberians united their settlements and declared independence from the USA. Their stated aims were for the country to become a beacon of liberty modeled after the United States, with the Constitution closely following the US Constitution, and the governmental structure also designed along American lines, with a president, a Senate, and a House of Representatives, and a separate judiciary with a Supreme Court. However, in practice, it has never operated at all like the USA in its entire history, as we shall see. Liberia was recognized by Great Britain in 1848. This was important because Britain was the global superpower at this time and a major influence in the region. Incidentally, the USA did not recognize Liberia as a sovereign state until 1862, because the Liberians had restarted the slave trade. One thing to note in this early period of Liberia's history is that the country quickly got itself into financial trouble. They had established a new currency called the Liberian dollar, initially on par with the US dollar, with real minted coins. However, it quickly depreciated and they issued paper money before the currency became next to worthless in the early 1870s, and they adopted the pound sterling on the gold standard. As Lee A. Gardner argues, this was good for the Americo-Liberian elites who had access to foreign trade, but not so much for the tribal natives. By 1869, said elites had established the True Whig Party. Its first president was Edward James Rowe. They held power continuously from 1877 to 1980. Even though Liberia was nominally a republic along American lines in theory, in practice it was a one-party state which operated a dual legal system. Americo-Liberians were only 2% of the population and occupied the coastal strip, while native tribal Liberians were restricted to live in the hinterlands. Special taxes and coercive sanctions were imposed on the tribal Liberians. Regulations controlled tribal residence and migration. Tribal Liberians were forced into both private and public labor, although they were paid in order to ensure that the USA did not see it as slavery. Tribal Liberians could not vote. During its first 79 years, it is fair to say that Liberia achieved nothing whatsoever. They built scarcely any infrastructure. They developed no industry. They failed to establish basic modern utilities, such as an electricity grid or public sanitation. The next major milestone in Liberian history came in 1926, when this chap, Harvey Firestone, founder of the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, showed a rare interest in making an investment. He was granted a 99-year lease for 1 million acres of land to set up rubber plantations. Rubber was not indigenous to Liberia, and Firestone had to establish the operations from scratch. However, the deal came at a cost. Not only did Firestone have a complete monopoly on rights to rubber production in Liberia, but also, as part of the deal, he provided the Liberian government a loan of $5 million at 7% interest to clear current debts and to build a harbour, which the company needed to export its shipments of rubber. The loan was given in exchange for complete control over the Liberian government's revenues until it was paid back. The loan kept growing as a portion of Liberian government income until, by 1932, it was 100% of revenues. These loans were not fully repaid until 1952. I don't think it is too much of an exaggeration to say that for a period of about 26 years, Liberia was an owned subsidiary of the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, and the company remains, to this day, the nation's largest employer. Although, interestingly, that 99-year lease is up in 2025, and the question of whether or not it will be extended has been a live issue for some time. Anyway, in 1944, Liberia elected this man, William Tubman, pictured here with John F. Kennedy, who became brutally repressive after an assassination attempt in 1955. It was widely believed that the assassination attempt was a false flag ordered by Tubman himself so he could enact emergency powers. He remained president for 27 years until his death in 1971. They didn't bother with all that term limit business in Liberia. Now, even by the 1960s, and even with the huge investments by the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, Liberia was still severely underdeveloped. As Dalton put it, Liberia enjoyed none of the benefits of European colonization, which in some measure were conferred on most other African countries. It received neither the tangible benefits of roads and schools, nor the more important but less tangible benefits of trained administrators and a civil service ethic of efficient and honest performance. Instead, the traditional practices and values of Americo-Liberian society were carried into the post-war period. By the early 1960s, after well over 100 years as a nation, Liberians had set up virtually no infrastructure. The vast majority of the population was illiterate. Less than 10% could read or write. 25% of the workforce were recruited involuntarily. That means they had been forced into labour. As Dalton explains, it had two trade unions in 1962, but the president's son was the head of one, and the president's social secretary was the head of the other. Strikes were illegal, and there were no collective bargaining contracts. It had a minimum wage law, 4 cents an hour, but the law did not cover agricultural and domestic workers, who comprised more than 80% of all non-governmental wage workers. By 1960, out of a population of 1.12 million people, only 82,000 had salaried jobs. Of these, 1 in 7, that's 11,600, worked for the government, mostly rewarded for loyalty. Collective punishment, i.e. the whole family was punished, was dispensed to those who opposed the government. Until 1944, the hinterlands had no representation in parliament. By paying a $100 tribute, tribes could send a representative to Congress, but without a vote. After 1944, they introduced universal suffrage, but with heavily, almost comically, rigged elections. The electoral reform was done solely to give the appearance of democracy to the USA and Europe. Nepotism and cronyism were total. This map shows just how many of William Tubman's family were embedded in key positions of influence and power across every facet of life. Liberian society was locked in a caste system with most of the population, over 95%, in category E here, tribal or uncivilized. Around this time, Tubman enacted an economic policy known as Open Door. This referred to the fact that Liberia was ready for more foreign direct investment following the Firestone model. It was a success, with mainly American investors coming in to set up iron ore and shipping operations, that is, the construction of naval vessels and battleships. This saw an 800% increase in government revenues in 10 years. However, increased effective demand because of higher wages did not induce an increase in domestic enterprise or production, but simply increased imports. Government borrowing increased too, from near zero after the Firestone debt was finally paid off, to over $100 million, which in today's money is over $863 million. This might not sound like a lot, but consider that the population of Liberia was only 1 million. Or in other words, for every Liberian citizen, the government owed $100. They didn't borrow this money to build anything tangible, such as infrastructure or public utilities. Either the money went exclusively on government wages. And as you saw, that was mostly the president's own extended family. In terms of the workforce, 65% of the population were in subsistence agriculture. That basically means they were living in the bush in the hinterlands. 30% of them were unskilled labourers, mostly working on rubber farms, earning an average of 75 cents a day. And 5% were the professional class who worked in government or else were absentee landowners or lawyers. Almost all staff positions in rubber or iron ore operations were foreign. The basic structure of the economy looked like this. It was overwhelmingly reliant on the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, which still enjoyed a monopoly contract for exports, so was the only buyer of rubber from the 2,600 independent Liberian-owned rubber plantations. George Dalton, who had spent some years posted there doing field work as a development economist, concluded his 1965 report on a somewhat despondent note. This is Dalton. Foreign economists who work in countries like Liberia confront a dilemma. If they confine themselves to conventional measurement, economic analysis, and policy prescriptions for development, they are wasting their effort. The governing authorities of Liberia have no intention of developing the national economy and the Liberian people. Under present political and social arrangements, offering economic advice to Liberian leaders is futile. What is the point of showing them how to increase tax revenues by $5 million if the revenue would be frittered away on objects and activities that have little, if any, effect on national welfare or development? Economic development is the proper concern of economists, but in Liberia, political and social reform are the most important of all preconditions for development. And so economists are forced into political and social as well as economic analysis. After Trubman died, his longtime deputy, William R. Talbot, took over. With corruption near total, Samuel Doe staged a violent coup d'etat, executing President Talbot and much of the true Whig Party leadership. Doe was the first native, which is to say indigenous or tribal, leader of Liberia. The Americo-Liberians, a tiny elite that had dominated the country since its foundation in 1847, had finally been toppled. Unfortunately, despite some initial successes, opening the ports for foreign trade with Canada, China, and Europe in the early 1980s, Doe proved to be just as bad as the old Americo-Liberians. Doe was part of the Kran ethnic group, which had its own tribal affiliations. And essentially, all that happened is that the Kran replaced the Americo-Liberians as the new elites. After a failed attempt on his life in 1985, Doe, like Trubman before him in 1955, became brutally repressive, shut down the newspapers, and banned all political activity. His mistreatment of certain ethnic tribal groups caused division and violence. Meanwhile, the renegade international fugitive Charles Taylor, who had been on the run since 1983, emerged leading a guerrilla force called the National Patriotic Front of Liberia, which had been trained in Libya by Colonel Gaddafi, who had taken in Taylor as his protege. Striking from the Ivory Coast, Taylor launched an attack on Liberia in order to overthrow Doe. To make matters more complicated, in the middle of all this, and in scenes reminiscent of Monty Python's Life of Brian, one of Taylor's senior commanders, Prince Johnson, broke off the NPFL to form the INPFL, that is the Independent National Patriotic Front of Liberia. Johnson then captured Monrovia, the Liberian capital, captured Samuel Doe, and then tortured him to death. He is also alleged to have done the same to several Firestone tire and rubber executives. Anyway, this sent the country into chaos, as the conflict fragmented along ethnic and tribal lines in an eight-way battle, which included the Americo-Liberians still vying to get back into power. Johnson was briefly president, but it was decided that the Americo-Liberian academic Amos Sawyer should act as an interim president while there was such conflict between Johnson and Taylor. Now, I want to keep this video reasonably family-friendly, so I will spare you the grisly details of the carnage that followed during the Liberian Civil Wars, during which every act of atrocity and depravity imaginable took place. They must surely rank as some of the most brutal in history. Suffice it to say that Charles Taylor's 1997 presidential campaign slogan, "He killed my ma, he killed my pa, but I will vote for him," says it all. A catalogue of all the terrible things Taylor did in his life would take a whole other video. He was tried in The Hague for war crimes and crimes against humanity in 2012 and sent to a special prison for 50 years. But remarkably, not for his atrocities in Liberia, but for his role in the civil war in neighbouring Sierra Leone, where he was also causing trouble. The judge said he was guilty of some of the most heinous and brutal crimes in recorded history, and you can see a list of them here. Anyway, let's look at the impact of the civil wars on Liberia. What little infrastructure there was had been destroyed. The economy shrunk by 90%. 95% of health facilities had been destroyed. The debt-to-GDP ratio reached 800%, which means for every dollar the government spent, they owed 8 back. 8% of the population had died, around 250,000 people in total. Cannibalism was widely reported. Many people were living on bushmeat, that's feeding on elephants, chimpanzees, hippopotamuses, and other such wild creatures. And now, in 2020, 83% of the population are living below the poverty line. Only 15% of the population are in legal labour. That means they're part of the official labour statistics. GDP per capita is $297. To put this in perspective, that is almost 20,000 times lower than the GDP per capita of the USA. More than 58% of women have undergone female genital mutilation. More than 20% of children are malnourished. 83% of people are without basic sanitation. 2% of the population are HIV positive, and 90% of food is imported because domestic production is negligible. As I was doing research for this video and considering the depressing history of this country, the thing I found most dispiriting was that in no time in its 173-year history did it even look like anything would get going. The only things remotely approaching good news in Liberian history came from elsewhere. That's the foreign investment, foreign enterprise, rather than coming from the Liberians themselves. This is especially disheartening for someone like me who believes in the power of entrepreneurship and individual private enterprise. But this never flourished at any point in Liberia's history. Now, people will debate the reasons and the factors for why this is, and I will leave that to them. But there it is, the real Wakanda. Now get out. In this video, I'm going to discuss an episode in Iranian history little discussed outside of Iran, known as the White Revolution, an initiative set forth by the last Shah. If you're unfamiliar with the recent history of Iran, I'd point you to a previous video of mine called The History and Politics of Modern Iran, a Primer. An aspect of this video will make more sense to you if you know everything I explain there. But back to the White Revolution, which is a textbook case of the road to hell being paved with good intentions. The situation in Iran in the 1950s was that around 150 families controlled more than half of the arable land. One landowner held an area the size of Switzerland. A dozen landlords controlled between 40 and 50 villages each. The Shah wanted to break this old power structure, which had persisted in one form or another for over 2,500 years, and to give the land to the peasantry. In this, he was opposed by the clergy, also known as the mullahs, the feudal landlords, the wealthy aristocracy, and the remnants of Mossadegh's old National Front. Incidentally, the Shah's reforms came to be known as the White Revolution because he intended it to be bloodless and to counter any possible Red Revolution from Mossadegh's old supporters and communist groups, and to counter what he called a Black Revolution from the clergy. After a decade of talking about such measures, in 1961, the Shah overrode all objections with an executive order on the 11th of November. He declared, "The interests of the nation override all other considerations. If we concern ourselves with impractical regulations and lose the favourable opportunity available to us now, we shall commit a great sin. The progress and development of the nation should be given priority over adherence to impractical laws and personal tests. With utmost speed, the government should intensify its drive against corruption and uproot it in the shortest possible time. No obstacle should stand in the way of the government's translating this program into practice. I am confident that the intelligent and honorable people of Iran will cooperate sincerely with the government in carrying out this program and thus will add to the historic honors of the nation." A 6-point plan, which was later expanded to 19 points, was introduced in January 1963 after a referendum gave the Shah's proposals a majority of over 99%, with only 4,115 votes of over 5.6 million cast against. The 6 points were, number one, land reforms to, quote, abolish feudalism. Number two, nationalization of forests and pasture lands. Number three, privatization of government-owned enterprises and industry. Number four, profit sharing, giving employees a 20% share of profits. Number five, expansion of the voting franchise to women. And number six, formation of a literacy corps to educate the population, 66% of whom could not read or write. On the passing of the bill, the Shah claimed that this was one of the most significant events in 3,000 years of Iranian history. He said, "My dear nation, from now on, we together shall turn the pages of history. With God's help, we shall build a most progressive and vigorous country. The shackles of slavery and bondage are broken forever." In these efforts, he was strongly supported by the Americans and personally by JFK. Indeed, Lyndon B. Johnson had met with the Shah when he was the vice president in 1962, and the Shah aped LBJ's rhetoric. But instead of talking about the Great Society, he talked instead about the Great Civilization. Naturally, the Shah's intentions were not totally benign. He also had political hopes attached to these reforms. First, he hoped that the peasantry would be grateful to him for freeing them from the shackles of feudalism and releasing them from ruthless and exploitative landlords, and therefore they would support him as new patriotic citizens. Second, that the old aristocratic power base would be broken. And third, to appease the newly educated professional middle class who were travelling abroad and watching Western television. The new professional middle class should not be underestimated. 17,000 students attended university every year within Iran, and around 15,000 were being educated abroad. Around 40,000 Iranians were traveling for business and pleasure. There were over 1 million radio sets and over 67,000 TV sets, reaching an audience of around 670,000 people. The university-educated people who had experienced Western modernity or who had seen it in the media were starting to ask questions of the Shah's regime and wondering why such freedoms were not enjoyed in Iran. So some aspect of what the Shah was doing can be seen as a kind of virtue signal to appeal directly to this class of people by helping the poor unwashed peasants. However, the measures did not resonate with many of the peasants themselves, since the Shah had used Western phrases such as feudal, which meant absolutely nothing to them. Concepts that seemed virtuous to metropolitan elites were completely alien to a peasantry who could not read nor write. Another issue was tribal nomadism. Unlike in Europe, where the peasantry had been fixed to specific locations, in Iran, due to its geographic features, fixed agricultural settlements were not the norm, and a significant portion of the population were both tribal and nomadic. One of the driving forces behind the land reforms was a man called Hassan Arsanjani, who openly was contemptuous of the old nomadic ways of life. He decried them as a vestige of the Dark Ages. He wanted to end this medieval practice of migration and living in tents, which is useful for little except the opportunity it gave foreigners to take photographs of them. He wanted the nomadic tribes to settle in agricultural areas and become farmers. He said the Iranian peasant, who, although wholly illiterate, could recite his national epic by heart, was filled with resources of intelligence and character which had been untapped for centuries. The lamp and the bulb were there, only the liberation of a just social order was needed to supply the necessary connection and the electric current to light them. Every aspect of Persian life and initiative began in the village. The only real source of a potential resurrection of Iran was the Persian peasant. However, the clergy objected to the land reforms on three counts. First, they argued that existing conditions were not feudal. Second, they said that these measures do not constitute progress, but rather social and economic dislocation. Third, they said it is illegal under Islamic law. On the claims of feudalism, the clergy argued that the high estimation of Arsanjani and others of the peasantry is misplaced. There's no need to romanticize these people, they argued. Second, that radical change to these socio-economic patterns that have endured for centuries could harm agriculture and lead to mass migration to the cities. Third, they said that the peasants could not be transformed into patriots as the Shah hoped. As Sultan Sultani, a major landowner, put it, they were waiting for the camel's tail to reach the ground, which is a Persian expression meaning roughly when pigs will fly. The most outspoken critic of the White Revolution was Ayatollah Khomeini, who made a famous speech against it in June 1963. More on that in a moment. The Shah, meanwhile, launched a counter-charm offensive targeting the 75% of the Iranian population who were peasants. It was a battle for their hearts and mind with the clergy. He said, "The next generations will live in an environment which I hope will be equal and comparable to the highest social standards anywhere on the planet. Thus, on this road, the free men and free women of Iran must head towards the future. Your income should be such that you and your family are full, that you will have smart clothes, that you will have a nice house." Unfortunately for him, these arguments mostly fell on deaf ears. The Shah's appeals to universal and rational norms were seen as inextricably Western and meant very little to traditionally minded Iranians, to whom the clergy were making a lot more sense. In June 1963, after giving the aforementioned speech, the Shah had Ayatollah Khomeini arrested and then exiled, especially for speaking out not only against the land reforms, but also against women's emancipation. This led to riots, which the Shah ruthlessly suppressed. And with his regime increasingly engaging in censorship and resorting to authoritarian measures to put down dissent, he lost the support of both the educated middle class and the peasantry. Thus, he somehow managed to lose support of both the liberals and the conservatives. The land reforms were implemented by the government paying the old landlords for their land and instructing them to invest the money in industry. The land was then sold to peasants at 30% below the market value, using 25-year loans at very low interest rates. 1.5 million peasants took advantage of the offer, around half of the total peasant population. So what was the upshot of all of this? Many of the families who acquired the farms struggled to make ends meet beyond subsistence level. In fact, life was arguably harder for many of them than it had been under the old quote-unquote feudal relations. Then, those landless peasants who were not able or willing to buy farms, as predicted by the clergy, migrated to the cities. The old aristocracy, as had been instructed, became industrialists, effectively recreating their old relationships with the landless peasants who had become their workers. The very socially conservative peasants resented the Western influences they saw in the cities, for example, women wearing short skirts, and particularly the bid to educate and emancipate women. In order to understand this, you have to put yourself in the mindset of an illiterate peasant who has been uprooted from his traditional way of life, thrust into the city, and then on top of that told to accept Western-style feminism and liberal values. With the greatest will in the world, how did anyone expect it to happen? These factors would contribute significantly to the Shah's eventual overthrow and the Islamic Revolution of 1979. The Shah, it seems to me, is a truly tragic figure. He had, in his own mind, the noblest intentions. I do not doubt that he wanted to help his people, but he will go down in history as the last Shah of Iran, breaking a line of kings going back to 678 BC. Be sure to like this video and subscribe, and if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating, or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out. Haiti is a small country about the size of Belgium, located in the Caribbean on the island of Hispaniola. It is on the west side of that. In this video, I'm going to have a look at its economic history. Christopher Columbus arrived in Hispaniola in 1492 with 40 men. They built Navidad Fort with the wood from their shipwreck. Columbus went back to Spain, and when he returned, the natives had killed all 40 men. There were estimated to be between 100,000 and 8 million natives in Hispaniola when Columbus arrived. By 1548, less than 500 remained. They were killed by a combination of Spanish brutality, forced labour, and disease. The discovery of gold in the early 1500s meant that the island became of key strategic importance, as efforts to mine this gold were accelerated. In order to fix their labour shortage due to the loss of the original natives, the Spaniards depopulated the entirety of the Bahamas. By 1600, they were already importing African slaves to try to resolve the scarcity of labour. These slaves would later become the Haitian peasantry. The Spaniards completely exhausted the gold supply in Hispaniola by 1630. In the mid-1600s, The discovery of gold in Mexico and Peru drew Spanish immigrants away from Hispaniola. By 1640, they had virtually deserted the island. However, the French started to arrive in significant numbers. By 1697, the French controlled the entire western third of Hispaniola, and the colony of Saint Domingo became the most profitable colony in the entire world. The French built this economy exporting sugar, coffee, cotton, and indigo. They relied almost exclusively on African imported slave labor. The French imported many thousands of slaves at the following rates: 4,000 per annum in the 1720s, 5,000 per annum in 1753, 10,000 per annum in 1771, 27,000 per annum in 1786, and 40,000 per annum between 1787 and 1789. By 1790, there were over 450,000 slaves in San Domingo. On the 14th of August, 1791, slaves held a voodoo ceremony in Bois Canain in northern Haiti. A week later, the slaves rose up against their masters and initiated a 12-year-long war. General Leclerc, Napoleon's brother, led an invasion force from France to Haiti in 1804, and his forces were overcome by yellow fever and defeated by the Haitian army. Now, let's take a quick break to hear about my fantastic economics course, and when we return, we will see what's happened to Haiti after the revolution.
If you like Academic Agent's content on this channel, sign up for a course on the Academic Agency. He's now offering Foundations of Economics. Click the link in the show description and level up your econ knowledge.
The ravages of war destroyed the basis of the plantation society in Haiti. On the eve of the slave uprising, San Domingo supplied 60% of the world's coffee. But coffee was not even its biggest export. That was sugar. Plantations required intensive capital and labor, typically between 150 and 300 hectares of land, and a large labor force working practically around the clock. Between 1790 and 1805, the population of Haiti decreased from 520,000 to 380,000 due to the war toll and expulsion of the French. The total labor force was reduced by 20%. Furthermore, the former slaves simply destroyed the plantations, and with them, the capital stock. In November 1803, almost the entire colony, formerly flourishing, was a big cemetery of ashes and debris. Tens of thousands of cultivators and soldier cultivators had died. The huts, if they were still standing, were deserted. The cities were burnt out. The sugar mills had been demolished or showed the stumps of the carbonized beams. The majority of the plantations had been reduced to ashes. Only the small plots planted with coffee and food crops spoke of life in the country. To show the impact of the destruction, we can have a look at the relative level of exports. In 1795, sugar exports were just 1.2% of their level in 1789. Coffee exports in 1795 were just 2.8% of the level in 1789. Cotton and indigo export industries were practically wiped out. Now, during the colonial period, there arose a class called the mulattoes, who were the mixed race offspring of French masters and their slave mistresses. The group had become an elite in their own right and owned their own slaves by 1791. This group, combined with the upper echelons of the black Haitian military, formed a new ruling class. They sought to maintain the existing structure of the plantations. The mulattoes needed money to supply themselves with arms in case of any new invasion from the French. They did not wish to work themselves because they believed that the elite ruling class should not work. Haiti had a lot of free land and a newly free peasantry, but the new Haitian ruling elite feared that such peasants would not be easily controlled under such conditions. So they used their military to force the peasant population back onto the plantations, effectively reinstituting forced labour. Jean-Jacques Dessalines nationalised all of the land in Haiti and then leased it back to the mulatto plantation owners. The population was divided into soldiers and workers. Anyone who was not a soldier would be forced to work at gunpoint in the plantations. Thus, slavery endured in all but name in Haiti after the revolution. Dessalines was murdered in 1806, and Haiti then split into two kingdoms. The northern kingdom was taken over by Henri Christophe, pictured on the right here, and the southern kingdom was taken over by Alexandre Pechon. The forced labour system was ended in 1809 in the south and was effectively over by 1816 in the more aristocratic north. Pechon adopted the Napoleonic Code and instituted a land reform in 1809. This ruled that large estates needed to be divided equally between offspring when inherited. This resulted in a continual subdivision of landholdings becoming smaller and smaller with each generation until reaching 0.75 hectares or less by 1995. This created a permanent peasantry of subsistence farmers. After Jean-Pierre Boyer unified Haiti in 1820, he maintained this system. Now, this system of inheritance created some odd effects. Every generation, the population grew, but the per capita land held by each household reduced because it kept on being divided by the offspring. Thus, Haitian GDP per capita was continually flat from 1809 onwards, as you can see in the bottom graph there. The top one shows the rising population. This also had the effect of severe soil erosion, since peasants had to rely on their own holdings exclusively, and therefore there was no crop rotation. This also had the effect of making the Haitian state completely predatory. Since the peasants were now landowners in their own right, they could no longer be forced to work for exports, and so they were taxed instead. Thus, holding high office in Haiti became the exclusive preserve of a ruling elite. Whichever faction was in power could then use the offices of state to plunder the peasant population through taxation. Corruption at the level of government thus became a way of life. Rival factions and coups were common. From 1843 to 1915, Haiti had 22 presidents, 11 of whom were in office for less than a year. All but five were deposed violently. This period saw more than 100 coups, uprisings, or attempted coups. The combination of soil erosion, kleptocracy, constant social turmoil, and the fact that every generation would be poorer than the last one on a per capita basis, if you include land in that calculation, meant that by 1915, Haiti was one of the poorest countries in the world. The country had effectively been in a state of civil war for 70 years. It had gone from being the most prosperous colony in the world to the poorest and least productive country in the Caribbean. And you can have a look at a comparison of Haiti to its direct neighbor there, the Dominican Republic, which is on the same island of Hispaniola on the east side. And you can see how it compares to South America, the Caribbean, and Central America as well. Incidentally, most of those countries maintained a mixture of small landowners and large landowners. And you could argue that one of the reasons for Haiti's very poor productivity was the fact of these continually diminishing land holdings, especially when you're growing things like coffee and sugar, you need economies of scale. And of course, the continual fighting and the heavy taxation didn't help either. By 1915, Haiti was practically bankrupt and in severe debt. Haiti had taken out pretty big foreign loans, chiefly from the USA, in 1874, 1875, 1896, and 1910. By 1910, Haiti's credit rating was such that no country in the world would lend to it at any interest rate. Thus, the Haitian government took to lending from its domestic capital market, and it took domestic loans in 1911, 1912, 1913, and in 1914 as well. It was, by this point, for all intents and purposes, bankrupt. So then, in 1915, the USA invaded and occupied Haiti. President Woodrow Wilson gave the order, and he claimed it was to ward off the increased influence of Germany. But I think that the real reason was to ensure that Haiti paid its debts back. The Americans established law and order for 19 years of peace and forced the Haitians to repay all of their long-standing debts. The debt had been halved by 1930, and it was fully paid off by 1947. The Americans also drastically improved the transport network in Haiti and established a school system. However, after the USA pulled out of Haiti in 1934, the transport network was not maintained and left to deteriorate. From reading around, I'm led to believe that you can still see the vestiges of the transport network that the Americans built even today in 2020. The education system was effectively abandoned. However, the Americans also helped to modernize the Haitian armed forces, and this resulted in a virtual police state after they left. The military, between 1934 and 1957, called virtually all of the political shots. This did, however, at least temporarily, put an end to the constant civil wars that had plagued Haiti before 1915. Sadly for Haiti, it also laid the groundwork for the rise of a man called François Duvalier, also known as Papa Doc. Duvalier became president in 1957. He ruthlessly persecuted all forms of opposition. He retired and exiled the entire officer class of the military and replaced them, the entire top brass, with personal cronies. He then brought the judiciary, the business community, the parliament, the media, and even the Catholic Church under his complete control. Duvalier created a new elite, a new support structure for his regime, which rested on three pillars. First, you have the Tonton Mokout, which was used to intimidate and liquidate people. All government officials had to join this group to prove their allegiance to Papa Doc. Next, you had the voodoo clergy, also known as the Mambos, which was very influential with the peasant population and now preached that Papa Doc had divine powers. The third part of the new elite were the chefs de section, which were local sheriffs, and they acted as the arm of the government in every community. When Papa Doc died in 1971, he had amassed $150 million in personal wealth, when the total GDP of Haiti was $362.8 million. This means that Papa Doc's personal total wealth as a percentage of Haitian GDP was 41.3%. His son, Jean-Claude Duvalier, dubbed Baby Doc, then became the new president. Now, Papa Doc had built structures that were only loyal to him. So when Baby Doc took over, he tried to transition back to the old Haitian system. He moved away from the voodoo clergy and so on, and back to the traditional elites. He focused his rule on a more technocratic and administrative basis, but was no less predatory than his father. When he was overthrown in 1986, having amassed $1.6 billion, it was at a time when the total Haitian GDP was $2.31 billion. That means that his wealth as a percentage of Haitian GDP was 69.3%, quite a staggering number. Then from 1986 onward, sadly for Haiti, we see more bloodshed and turmoil. More civil war ensued after Baby Doc was overthrown. A man called Jean-Bernard Aristide was elected president in 1990 with a two-thirds majority, but then he was ousted by the military and exiled in 1991. And then he was reinstated by direct intervention by the USA in 1994. Aristide became president again in 2001, but suffered a second military coup in 2004. Then in 2010, the natural disaster of the earthquake struck Haiti at a time when the country was experiencing its habitual civil strife. Haiti today remains one of the poorest countries in the world, ranked 169 out of 189 nations, with a GDP per capita of just $756. Unfortunately, the history of Haiti shows what happens when political leaders see their offices as nothing but seats of plunder for their own personal gain.
If you like Academic Agents content on this channel, sign up for a course on the Academic Agency. He's now offering Foundations of Economics. Click the link in the show description and level up your econ knowledge.
Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.